Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello and welcome. I'm Gabriel Marcotti and I'm here with The Game, the football podcast from The Times. In today's program, we'll be looking at the heavyweight clashes in the FA Cup and Premier League. And as the Champions League approaches the quarterfinal stage, we'll talk some financial fair play there. That gets you all excited there, doesn't it? And also about some of those sneaky things those sneaky French at Paris Saint-Germain are doing. And of course, if we're going to talk about sneaky French, we have a sneaky Frenchman of our own. It's Julien Laurens, and he's joined by our boss, Tony Evans. And because Ollie Kay is feeling a little bit under the weather today, you might think that his team lost yesterday or something. Alison Rudd steps in. Definitely an upgrade in my book. But let's start at Old Trafford. Okay, so United and Chelsea, obviously Manchester United were looking to bounce back in midweek. Sir Alex made a big deal of saying that they were tired, having played a home game on Tuesday. And he drops Robin Van Persie. Now, I know it's one goal in eight, Tony. I want to get your take on this. I kind of feel that this is a pretty nasty slump, and it's kind of been overshadowed. Nobody's really talked about it because of the Rooney shenanigans and the red card. Should we be talking more about Van Persie?
Well, I think we probably should do, because I mean, a month ago we were talking about him as a shoo-in for the, you know, footballer of the year, and yeah, as he's dropped off a cliff, you know, it's gone very quiet. It was a strange decision to leave him out though yesterday. You would have thought his movement and intelligence would be perfect against, let's say, David Luiz's naivety. You know, it's so I was a bit surprised that he left him out. Let's face it, what you want to do is get your goal scorers back on the team and get them on a scoring run again. But yeah, he's struggling at the moment, and he's not hitting the ball very cleanly, is he?
No, not at all. I think we saw that against Real Madrid as well. Alison, meanwhile, and you'll forgive me, but while Rory K. Smith isn't here, you have to step in and be the Rafa avatar. I'm sure we'll give him a lot of praise later for his substitutions, but to go two goals down with some pretty awful defending, is that on the manager?
It's always partly on the manager, but I think what Rafa's inherited is you know, he's got his interim problems, sure, but he has inherited difficulties there.
And Champions League winning
Czech
side.
Czech is one of the difficulties. I still think Czech's a great goalkeeper, but he's not. The trouble is, if you've had for years a keeper of the stature of Cech, and he has been astonishingly good, I think. I think it sort of breeds a slight not lethargy exactly, but you do sort of rely on your goalkeeper to always do the right thing and make the right decisions. It's almost as if, well, Cech won't be indecisive. We might expect David Luiz to be indecisive or whatever. But so I think because Cech is slightly going away from his best form, I still think he's good, but he's not as good as he was, then you know, what Chelsea defence have to be is just step up a bit, and there's a difference there that has yet to be made up. The defence hasn't yet got up to the point where they can compensate for a keeper that isn't quite as astonishing as he was.
Yeah, but do you think it's the other way around? I mean, you know, because let's face it, keepers, when they have defenders in front of them, they don't trust. You know, often look shaky. And let's face it, would you trust Cahill and would you trust David Luiz in front of your centre-halves? I wouldn't.
Well, he's got John Terry there, of course, who he doesn't play and who a lot of people seem to think might have made a difference on the Rooney free kick. Julian, you're nodding. Mm-hmm. Is you nodding because you admire brave John Terry and think that...
Because I agree with you. It's a weird one, the John Terry-Rafa relationship, I think. Because I understand the fact that he obviously came back from injury, unless there's something that we don't know about his injury and that maybe he's still not 100%, but, you know, he's playing sometimes, and then suddenly when you can give him a bit of a run over games, he keeps coming back to, oh yeah, but Cahill is doing okay, he's doing well, and David Luiz, who he tried to play at number six, you know, in that central midfielder role for a while, and then it didn't work in the end, so then he bring him back at the back now, and it's clearly, like Tony said, it didn't really work yesterday and didn't really look reassuring, and Terry's there on the bench completely unused, and I think that it's going to be too far, the story, and I think Rafa should maybe consider now putting Terry back in the starting lineup, you know, for a good run of play and see what happens then. If it's not as better than Cahill and Ivanovic or Cahill and Luiz or Luiz, then fair enough, but at least give him a chance to show that he can maybe reassure a bit more the team.
Should he do that? Or should he just say, I'm leaving? What do I care?
Isn't this about the way Rafa manages players? And we've known this about him since he joined Liverpool. He doesn't do intuition, and I think if you're the manager of John Terry, you have to have a feeling for what he brings to the team, because his stats won't be good. He's not fully fit. He's... in terms of match fitness and in terms of niggles, he, you know, his stats will not be great. Rafa does everything by numbers. Rafa will not allow Terry in the team unless he feels he's got more energy than Gary Cahill.
He will never be match fit if you don't play him either.
No, but it's the way Rafa operates. He needs Terry to prove that he's worth taking that risk, because his numbers don't add up. I'm just trying to explain why he's not giving him... I think you're right, Julian. I think you would expect most managers to give Terry a go now, but I don't think Rafa thinks the numbers add up.
I think if he thought he was fit, he'd have him in that team.
Okay, I think that's enough Chelsea for now. I'm sure we'll go back and talk handshakes. But let's talk United here, Julian. I thought even at 2-0, I thought they were poor, and I thought as badly as Chelsea started, and with all the, you know, crap that people gave Rafa, I thought they even had chances at the end of the first half.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I was really, I mean, it's 2 goals in 10 minutes for United, but I don't think they never look really comfortable, and they look to me quite complacent at times as well, and I think it's not the first time where they're in the lead and they put their foot off the gas a bit, and clearly what happened, I mean, the second half was dreadful. It was probably the worst half I've seen United this season, and it was at home as well. I mean, in midfield they were completely outplayed. Chelsea could have scored 5 in the second half, you know, and it was just waves of Chelsea players one after the other, and there was nothing, you know, at the back, nothing happened in midfield either. They were completely, I thought they were well off the mark completely.
What's the problem, Tony? Why? I mean, this is a team that could still realistically go and win the double, and that will likely win the Premier League by a big margin.
Mm.
And yet, this just looks bad. Rafael and Evra, I thought, were poor.
Yeah, you know, it's they're really struggling. I mean, Evra, the years are really telling on him at the moment, and he needs replacing. But again, we go back to the midfield. I mean, Carrick's had loads of plaudits this year, but that midfield just looks so weak to me. And certainly in the second half, the Chelsea runners were just flooding through without being picked up. And you're like... It's unbelievable. Every time I see United, I can't believe they're running away with the league like they are. It says two things. It said Ferguson's a genius, and it says the rest of the league is full of puddings.
Alison, is the rest of the league really full of puddings?
No.
Yeah, because I look at it and say, who's played consistently well? Of, you know, you could argue Spurs, who I guess we'll get to, are one of the few teams who played, I think, have been impressive this year, but... just so much dross at the top end of the Premier League.
Well, there's a lot that's brilliant there as well. I think United, you know, they have up until now managed to win games where they've been quiet, and we've come full circle back to Van Persie, because if you think back, he was rescuing points for them when we were saying exactly the same thing about the way they played against Chelsea. They'd have long lulls where they didn't appear to be terribly creative, very happy to absorb pressure, hit teams on the break. They use the flanks very well. When you've got someone like Van Persie, when he's playing extraordinarily well, then you're going to win the games. If you haven't got someone like that in form, it just fizzles out. And that's what they looked like, a team that had completely fizzled out.
Julian, I want to get your take on something here. United, well, one of the things that Sir Alex has always done, probably more than any other manager, is he's often rotated his squad, and he's done that very, very effectively. I think one of the reasons Ryan Giggs is now in his 20th year is that he really never played, I think, more than 50 games a season, even when they were winning trebles and whatnot. But I look at this now, and I'm sort of wondering: is this still the right thing to do? This kind of rotation. I guess the question is, do you rotate when you've got a bunch of guys who are at the same level, or do you rotate when you've got some guys who are better and some guys who are worse, and you play the worst guys in certain games? Because it seems to me that some of these guys are all kind of much of a muchness. They're good, but I sort of feel that if they played regularly, we would find out really what they're made of. I'm talking about Ashley Young, Nani, Hernandez, even Welbeck, who's the kind of guy who goes like 5 months without scoring. Should he revisit this? Should he actually try to build like a base 11 and then rotate around the edges?
I think he shows the weaknesses of his squad, to be fair, because like we said, Rafael and Evra were really poor yesterday because they look tired as well, because they've played 300 games in the season already. But if you look at it, who would have stepped in for them? You would have had Bentner on the left, who got probably humiliated by Mata, Oscar and Hazard. So you play Evra, although you know that he's shattered. And on the right, it's probably the same with Rafael. So I think he shows that on key positions.
Smalling, you could have had Jones, you could play Evans at left back, right?
Yeah, but Evans at left back, what kind of reassurance does that give you?
Do you know what I mean? Much going forward, but defensive.
And the one thing Everett does, he gives you an outlet. I mean, people have recognised it, and they squeeze him now, but he still makes himself available. If you put Evans out there, you're going to have to play the ball through the middle.
The other big Rafa talking point after the game was the handshake. Now, the record reflects we don't have, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Sir Alex's version of events here. So it's entirely possible that Rafa is either A, making everything up, or B, that Sir Alex wanted to shake Rafa's hands. But, there's a lot of people at Old Trafford and they just kind of missed each other, I suppose that can happen. But let's assume for a minute that Sir Alex chose not to shake his hand. Anybody here think that, hey, why should you shake his hand, right, after a game? Anybody think that that's ever acceptable behavior?
I do.
Ah, okay. Thank you, Julian.
I do. I don't like that handshake and all what we make of it. I think if you hate someone, like clearly Sir Alex and Rafa don't seem to really like each other, why would Fergie, who was probably very angry, shake his hands?
He just thinks you should kiss people on both cheeks.
Anybody else agree with Julian's frankly ludicrous
opinion? Not ludicrous. Why?
Because you're an employee in the entertainment industry, and this is part of the basic convention, right? You shake hands to signify, not that you're friends, you shake hands to signify that the duel is over, that hostilities have ceased.
I would be interested in seeing what Ferguson's side of this is. Certainly, seeing as he caused such a fuss over Suarez not shaking hands, and if he hasn't done it, it suggests a level of hypocrisy that we've never seen in the governed socialist night.
Alison?
Well, I think the reason they should shake hands is precisely because of Julian's reasoning, which is if you have allowed personalities to seep into the football match and your own personal feelings, to feel aggrieved and hurt and angry and dislike someone or hate them, the point is you're shaking hands to show that you're remembering that you're representing a football club and that you have done what you've done and it was a fair game, goodbye. It's a way of saying, with the handshake, you're not saying, hey, I really like you now, and no one would assume that. You're showing that you have the respect for the competition you're in and the club you represent.
You've seen some handshakes where they don't even look at each other. They hardly even touch their fingers with each other. That's probably not good either, anyway.
No, I agree with you. That's not good. You should shake hands properly. Otherwise, you're disrespecting the competition, I think.
I think you go back to Clive James, don't you, talking about Overton Co. in Moscow when they shook hands on the podium and said it looked like they were passing one another a dead turd.
Final point on this, the flip side is Rafa Benitez came and shared this news during the press conference afterwards, and of course also came out and said, oh, go ask Ferguson if you're brave enough. Tony, do you have to be brave to ask Sir Alex things? And secondly, was this a really good idea to go and make a big deal out of this?
Well, I think it goes back to Friday, doesn't it, last Friday, when Ferguson, when he was asked about Benitez, said, I don't want to kick a man when he's down. Kicked him when he's down. So, you know, Rafa won't have forgot that. Is it wise to bring it up?
Does Rafa help himself?
No.
Because let's face it, when you take on... I'm not saying you should never take on Ferguson, but if you take Ferguson on over silly things, and let's face it, there's an obvious axis now, Ferguson, Mourinho, going on here, right? Which obviously doesn't help Rafa in his day job with Chelsea, because Chelsea fans are singing Mourinho's name. Does this, like, really make sense? Do you need to go and pick another fight with this guy who you probably won't see again this year?
Well, he'd see it as Ferguson picked the fight with him on Friday. But he can't help himself, can he? You know, PR is not his greatest quality.
Julian, are you scared of Sir Alex Ferguson? Would you have asked him had you been there?
I would, because I, you know, he can ban me if he wants. He can ban my newspaper. I don't really care. But I mean, I can see the. I've been to a few press conferences. I was at the press conference where that poor guy from PA asked about Ryan Giggs' private life and so before the Champions League final or semi-final last season or the season before, and Fergie said to the press officer, United, just ban him, and everybody heard him, which was genius. But I can see why
press, as I recall.
Yeah, sorry, AP. Yeah, and yeah, yeah. I mean, I can see why probably some of the journalists may be a bit scared of him, but I don't think you should. Yeah.
Strange place, Manchester. Tony, you remember this? Remember when the whole Giggs stuff was going on, and all those guys in hoodies showed up outside of Giggs's house and beat up the paparazzi and then sped off?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Do you ever find out who those people were?
No, it's and we wouldn't want to speculate, would we?
No, not at all. All right, enough of that. Let's move on to a place where none of this kind of thing ever happens ever. That's right. Anfield, Liverpool, and Spurs. Julian, you're a neutral here in the Suarez and Bale duel, because let's face it, you're not a Liverpool fan, notoriously. And I don't think you describe yourself as a Spurs fan either, even though you do live creepily in that neck of the woods. But I thought Suarez really had the upper hand in this game, and if you were supposed to be like judge these guys on 90 minutes, despite Bale's two assists, do you agree with me?
Yeah, I do.
And then maybe Bale's going through a slight bumpy patch the last two, three games, last two games at least.
By his
high standards?
Well, maybe, but then there's that run, that 70-yard run, where then he crossed the ball for Sigurdsson, and Sigurdsson hit the post, which was just magnificent.
That is true.
And then you think, I do agree, I watched the game again last night, and I thought, well, Bale starts to look a bit tired, and then there's that run, and it just takes on everybody, and it's just fantastic. I mean, Suarez, what a player yesterday. I mean, in both sense of the word. As in, so annoying if you play against him, I think. I mean, if I had been Dembele, I would have smacked his head up. But such a talent, it's incredible. I mean, the goal is fantastic, although I think Lloris, you know, is a bit at fault on the first goal. But just the movement and just the cleverness he has on the pitch is just fantastic, I think.
Yeah, I couldn't praise him more highly than saying when he scored that goal, it reminds me of Dalglish. the way his body placements, the way he moved, the way he flicked it with the outsides of his foot, just brilliant.
Didn't Torres once score a goal like that too?
Yeah,
where he then ran off and
it's a different type of movement. You'd never say Torres reminds you of Dalglish. I mean, completely different players, you know. It's but Suarez isn't. You know, he's one of those players that you just can't get a handle on, get hold of in the boxing with his movements, the way he twists and turns, his runs. He's just, you know, he's fantastic. And, you know, and Bale's fantastic as well. I don't get why it seems to be an either or, you know, and there's this level of hating. And the other thing I don't get is, like, look, he dives as well. You know what? Let it all go. The two great players, diving doesn't matter.
Diving doesn't matter, Alison. Is this a lesson for the next generation?
Well, you don't. Oh, come on, Tony. You wouldn't want that to be high up in the list of things either player is going to be remembered for.
Well,
when they
I don't think they should be. I think it's like it's a classic like hobby horse of those who are missing the point. And you know, there are things in the game we should run out the game. We should get an angry mob, flaming torches, and run them out the game. And like diving's way down on that list.
Is it way down on that list, Alison?
No, it might be low on Tony's list. It's high on most other people's lists because it doesn't feel right. It does it when you are so talented. I mean, I'm not going to disagree. Bale and Suarez are the two most attractive players to watch at the moment. Two of them, anyway. And you kind of think, why do you need to do it?
Every week, there's people throwing in challenges that can potentially put people in hospital, and we just go, oh, that's all right, that's fine. Look at that dive and get.
Well, I think part of the argument is, A, culturally in this country, there's long been a fascination, right, with the hard man, right, McKay, Chopper Harris, Billy Bremner.
And no one gets that more than me.
Okay, so there's more tolerance for that rather than for the sneaky guy who dives and cheats and tries to get an advantage that way.
You know, those cheating foreigners like the Welsh, you know, they...
I was thinking about that, you know, ultimately Liverpool won this game because of two completely foolish back passes and one very bad decision from Asua Koto. And I'm wondering, because at one moment where I found myself praising Tottenham, they're so well organized and tactically it's great and they're so in sync, and then they do stuff that's so stupid, like the Defoe back pass and that weird Walker pass back to Lloris. Well, how does this stuff happen?
Well, just when you think they've stopped being Tottenham, they become Tottenham again, don't they? They remember who they are. And, you know, it's... I mean, frankly, they offended me yesterday. I mean, I was glad, of course, that, you know, Liverpool won. But, like, they were on top. They were cruising. And they are just the biggest bunch of mentally weak... Well, they turned into it on Sunday. And it was offensive, really. You know, Phyllis Bowers must be pulling his hair out. Just when you start believing, you say, yeah, this is beginning to work. And and you see it go wrong like that. You think to yourself, yeah, it does offend me. It offends me when teams switch off, when teams show mental weakness, when teams are on top and you lose. It just does. I can't help it.
It's a team that lacks a lot of experience, I think, of winning experience. You know, you've got good players and, you know, with different ages as well. But Vertonghen has never won.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Won anything, and Dembele has never won anything, and Dawson doesn't have the experience of winning top games and, you know, top trophies in top leagues either. Same for Lloris, you know, for example, that mistake Lloris made on the second goal. There's no way a very experienced goalkeeper would
want. He's obviously thinking there's no way that Walker's going to hit this.
No, maybe, but then
your pass. I mean, these are good players.
He could have
stupid mistakes.
Yeah, but you know, he could also have kicked the ball to, you know, into Goodison Park. across Stanley Park, because that's what he should have done anyway. But I think they lack experience in those, you know, in those final 10-15 minutes, and it's not the first time it shows.
But the good news, Alison, is that it's 3 points for Liverpool. Champions League is 5 points away. Should you start thinking about it?
I don't think so, really. No, I felt, I mean, I don't know if I'd use the word offended, but I definitely, that was not a game that Liverpool won, that was a game that Spurs lost, and...
Hey, Liverpool beat somebody in the top 10, right?
Yeah, well, for the first time, they beat a team higher than Swansea, which tells its own story. I don't think that they have progressed in the leaps and bounds that would allow them to now carry on taking points off the better teams in the division to the point where they're going to finish in the top four.
All right, you have little faith. We're going to do things slightly differently in our debate next week. Julian's going to help me explain this story because I think it's absolutely fascinating. We're talking about financial fair play for those who are unfamiliar with it. Basically, it's a set of regulations introduced by UEFA, which stipulate that which basically cap the amount of losses a club can sustain initially over a 2-year period. Then it becomes a 3-year period. Long and short is that for the first 2 years, losses are capped at 45 million euros in total, which is about 39 million pounds. Now, Paris Saint-Germain have spent close to 200 million pounds in the last 2 years alone on players. Their wage bill has gone out of control. They only make something like 90 million in revenue between gate receipts and sponsorship and broadcasting revenue. And yet, bizarrely, when they issued their accounts to the French regulatory body, hey, look, they only made a loss of 5.5 million last year. Julian, can you tell us how that was possible?
Well, it's, to try to make it easier, I mean, simple. Basically, they found a few loopholes in the French tax laws that enable them not to cheat on their accounts, but to actually reduce their losses.
Your newspaper, Le Parisien, reported that they signed this big sort of partnership agreement with the Qatari Tourist Board.
Yeah.
And as you know, the owners of Paris Saint-Germain are Qatari as well. In fact, it's basically the same people.
Yeah.
Which supposedly pays them between 150 and 200 million a season. And they decided that even though they only announced this in January, presumably only did the deal in January, so 2 months ago, they decided it was going to somehow be backdated to last year's accounts as well.
Yeah.
And that way they would not make a loss. Now, how is this possible?
Well, again, they said they've just announced it in December, but that it was in the pipeline for a long time and that they signed it already. So bearing in mind that it's basically your dad giving his son some money because that tourism board belongs to the people who own the club as well. So it's exactly like the money just staying in the family. You say, okay, I just give you 200 million quid because, well, I've got them and I want to please you. So that's the story. And they just find that loophole enabled them to clearly backdated all the paperwork and everything, saying that it was actually done a long time ago so it could go back to last year's accounts. And obviously, if you add 150 million euros to your accounts, it makes a complete difference.
Okay, now, Tony, now UEFA have very clear rules about this, namely that...
Really?
This is a related party transaction. And so they're going to go and they're going to use what they call benchmarks. We're going to say...
And that's clear?
Annex 11, yeah. I mean, it's in there. They're saying that this is what they say that they do.
Do they explain how the benchmarks work? Do they explain what the benchmarks are? No, they don't. It's not clear. And you're going to be able to drive a truck through it. And this is the first instance of a truck driving through it. And it's absolutely scandalous. But, I mean, the whole point about financial fair play is that it's nothing to do with fair play. It's about ring fencing the rich and the powerful.
Oh, well, I think we're in agreement on that point. Alison, Tony seems to think that UEFA aren't going to take this seriously. People I've spoken to assure me that they will, and they kind of like laughed when they saw what Paris Saint-Germain were trying to do there. It seems to me, though, that it's a typical case where there's a lot of big clubs who want to see financial fair play there. They're the ones who push for it, the likes of Bayern and Manchester United, who make a profit every year. Surely, do you think they're going to allow UEFA to not enforce the rules?
Well, I don't know that it's up to the likes of Bayern Munich and Man United to be in a position to allow UEFA to do or not to do something. They can lobby. There's a dream there, isn't there? And I mean, I think probably UEFA went down this path because they saw that it wasn't just a pipe dream, that it is real, that clubs, and we're always lauding German clubs for being able to run economically, you know, good housekeeping and still be successful. So if it's possible, then why can't all clubs do it? The problem is that why should football be different to the way the world is? There was a report out this weekend, I think, saying that, you know, if you want to hide your profits, go to an accountant in London. We are very good at helping the very, very rich to appear like they're doing the right thing, but in fact not do it. And my cynicism would be that if you have a lot of money and you own a football club, you will find somebody to shift things around so that UEFA can look like they've done the right thing and there will be no penalties. And if you're rich enough, you can afford to, you know, to make a loss in some respects in order to make a bigger killing by avoiding the rules.
Julian, do you think if, for example, UEFA clamped down really hard on PSG over this, would they think of taking it to the European courts with these, you know, a restraint to trade? There's another big flaw in it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, they keep saying to us that they're completely adamant, they're doing nothing wrong, that deal with QTA, by the way, it's not even a sponsorship deal. The Qatar Tourism Board won't be written anywhere. It's just a representation deal, if you want. The PSG will represent Qatar through the world.
This is exactly this. I'll put on my UEFA hat here because, frankly, first of all, UEFA have had assurances from the European Commission. Right? European Court of Justice is separate. You want to take them to court? Go ahead. You take them to court, which you're expressly forbidden from doing by the European legislation and by FIFA legislation. You want to go to European Court of Justice? That's fine. And then be prepared then for 3 years, you know, no Champions League, nothing for you while you're all suspended, okay? Because that's what happened to Bosman. That's what you have to do if you want to go and sue UEFA or FIFA for that matter. Secondly, they said, and when they wrote these rules, it was together with people like Bayern and Manchester United. You imagine Gil and Henderson a rule saying, now, all these sort of sneaky, like, Mediterraneans, what rules can they make? Is Berlusconi going to go and, like, you know, sign a sponsorship deal with one of their own company for $100 bazillion? And what about those dodgy Russians? And this is exactly what those guys, and these are very smart people at very powerful clubs, well, this is what they wrote into the rules, so to give the rules the power to do it. And I wouldn't underestimate that the flip side of you don't punish Paris Saint-Germain for doing this, or you don't take certain measures against them. I said it's not just a case of Bayern and Manchester United lobbying UEFA. Bayern, Manchester United, Arsenal, Barcelona, these guys are the Champions League. I mean, I don't think we quite realize this. This is the compromise deal which keeps these teams within UEFA, within the Champions League, rather than running off to form their own European Super League. Yeah, which I think financial fair play will lead to anyway. But, I mean, there is some, I mean, for example, there is nothing wrong. If Manchester City, who were, funnily enough, trying to do things the right way. Right. If Manchester City all of a sudden decides Abu Dhabi are going to take hold of a number of huge sponsorship deals where money actually moves from one company to another, how would you set these benchmarks? So it's real money, it moves
right
across.
Right. Well, the answer is the way they set the benchmark, obviously it would be a related party transaction, because this is the other thing here, which for me personally makes my skin crawl, is that all these people are royals, okay? I realize you guys have your own rules. Your own. I know you're a big fan of the royal family.
Yeah,
stuff,
I would
Tony.
Say why. I always stand for the Queen.
But I find it kind of, frankly, creepy that these people are just born into this and they go and they start chucking money in other countries. But whatever. But in the case of the benchmarking, what they do is they look at, in the case of Manchester City, for example, they go and they look at, all right, what is the size of the club? There are how many fans do they have? How many season ticket holders? How much visibility does it have? Where can we find a comparable, clearly non-related transaction? And that might be the sponsorship deal signed by Real Madrid or Manchester United. They look at, say, United's deal. Say United's deal is $50 million. City's deal is also $50 million. But then they look, City, you're smaller than United. And so we're going to count this as a $35 million pound deal, for example, right? That's how they would do it, and this is sort of standard benchmarking that is used to go and put a value on these types of transactions.
So UEFA value judgments.
Sorry?
So UEFA sitting there making value judgments.
Yeah, pretty much. It's not. I mean, not Platini. There is a separate commission, and they go and employ people. But benchmarking is used to figure out the value of sponsorship and publicity contracts all the time, because a lot of times you know, from an accounting perspective, you need to put a price on this, and you can't just do it via a contract. And in the case of City, by the way, remember, people always seem to forget this, is there is sort of a hard cap, but UEFA have some flexibility there in the sense that as long as you're moving in the right direction, so if you're increasing revenue and lowering expenses over time, and if you can show that you've got a plan in the very near future to eventually meet the parameters, they will let you slide. I mean, that's in the rules as well.
It's interesting because I think PSG meet that commission from UEFA early July, something like that. And you just can't wait to see what's going to happen after that. What are they going to make of that QTA deal? What are they going to say? They're going to say that doesn't count. You just can't do that. And it'd be really interesting because it will set, like Tony was saying about benchmarks, that would be the benchmark. What are they going to do with PSG? Because if they start saying, well, okay, it's fine, you know, we'll let you go with it, then surely in Abu Dhabi they're going to find a way to do exactly that kind of same deal with City, to bring another 200 million to City, and then maybe all those like rich royals everywhere in the Middle East or something who owns football clubs will try to do the same, and then the benchmark will be that, well, actually anyone can do what the hell he wants.
As I said, and when that happens, that's when Barcelona, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich and Manchester United walk away and form their own Champions League, and then we'll see how much, if they allow it to get to that point. I mean, I think ultimately that's going to be the counter argument. How about some quick hits? And let's start with you, Tony, because you love talking about Everton. Everton implode against Wigan and find themselves 3-0 down at halftime before crashing out. Tony, does this kind of collapse say more about David Moyes or Roberto Martinez? Notice how I roll my R's.
I think people will say that David Moyes fails in the big games. And, you know, obviously they didn't play particularly well. But I think this is that there is more than 10, 12 years of problems at Goodison which are manifesting themselves. Now, I think Moyes has papered over a lot of cracks for a long time. I think he's reached the end of that. It'll be interesting to see what he does in the summer. And Martinez, well, you know, as I wrote this morning, I said, you know, the first signs of spring, the cuckoo, the sun comes out, Wigan start winning, and 3 months later we're punting up Martinez for the best jobs in the world. You know, on the evidence of 3 months where they fought relegation for eight. No, they did well, they played really well, but I'd like to see Martinez have a good season. A whole good season, and I'd like to see him, you know, not be fighting relegation before I start saying he's a wonderful manager.
Well, you almost got the chance to have him have a good season at Liverpool, no less.
Well, indeed.
Carlos Tevez nails a hat-trick as Manchester City demolish Barnsley 5-0 to advance to the FA Cup semi-final. Alisson, will Tevez be back next season? And who do you think will make that decision?
Strange question to me. I've never seen Tevez look so comfortable at a club as he does right this minute. So I think Tevez will want to stay. I can't see why Mancini, if he's still manager, wouldn't want him there. I don't think you're going to make a lot of money on him at the moment. Good though he is. I mean, you're not going to make a profit. So I may be incredibly naive, but I think Tevez will be at the Etihad next season.
QPR win again. Julian, the talk is of Harry Redknapp and great escapes once again. Now, I know for a fact that you were chilling with a QPR player last night, and so does everybody who tuned in to the fine entertainment of Lyon against Marseille, OL versus OM. So you must have some insight. Can they do it?
First, I think they need to relocate their training ground to Dubai, because clearly it seems to work, whatever they did over there. Two wins in the last two since coming back from that jolly holidays. And I think, yeah, they can do it. Definitely they're going to beat Villa on Saturday away. And
definitely they're going to beat Villa on Saturday.
Definitely.
And Nostradamus is broken here.
And after that, they'd be fine. And I think it's going to be a proper, proper great escape.
There you go. Swansea fall to West Brom, but Michael Laudrup is incensed that Roland Lamas's goal is struck off. Tony, now Lamas was in an offside position, but the ball was played back to him first by Gareth McAuley, then by Ben Foster. Now, you used to be a referee back when you were hanging in East LA with Los Lobos in the early 1990s. Please explain, because both Laudrup and Steve Clark said that the goal should have stood.
Well, you know, Los Lobos liked me, wanted me to join the band, and I always felt I was a bit too, like, you know, I wasn't Hispanic enough, so I didn't join. So that explains
you
that.
Not Hispanic enough.
Yeah, you know, it's the refried beans, the things they did to my stomach. But anyway, we move on. I was under the impression that when the ball comes off the last defender, it needs to be played deliberately to put you in an onside position, and I was under the impression that these rules were changed back in the late 70s. Because I seem to remember a game at Goodison where Andy King scored for Everton, and Liverpool equalised when the ball flipped off the last defender, and I think it was David Johnson was in offside position. He scored and it was overruled, and that was the first year that they changed the rule. And I thought that was 1978. Now, either I'm living in a bizarre dream world, an alternative reality, or Laudrup is.
Well, we have a qualified referee in our midst who we can ask. Now, Alison, surely you don't remember the game in 1978, as it was many years before you were born. But by the same token, you are familiar with the rules. Is Laudrup wrong?
Laudrup's never wrong.
So that implies that Tony's wrong.
Tony's never wrong. Yeah.
To be honest, I haven't seen the goal. But on my refereeing, you don't like them saying that on the podcast. But on my refereeing course, there was no deliberate where the ball went off whom, whether it's deliberate or not, does not come into it. The word deliberate was not part of our assessment of whether a goal was offside or not.
The plot thickens. Julian, everybody seems to have an opinion on this. Do you want to weigh in? Was it a goal?
It was a goal. Definitely it was a goal. But it's not clear. It's clearly not clear. Because I remember earlier in the season as well at Arsenal, I think, where the goal was disallowed for the same reason, and because the ball just came off the defender, but not in an intentional way. And then the referee ruled the goal out. So it's definitely not clear.
All right, now we return from this unscheduled break to we go right straight back to some quick hits. Now, Millwall and Blackburn Rovers are going to a replay. Yes, the magic of the cup. Alison, which one of these two sides has a better shot at denying Dave Whelan his return to Wembley?
Well, it's got to be Blackburn, I think, simply because Dave Whelan seems to get very emotional whenever Blackburn are mentioned. Oh my goodness! I mean, I mainly followed the Millwall Blackburn game on Twitter for various reasons. Well, Twitter was more exciting than the game. That's the real reason. And nobody could find anything remotely romantic or interesting or positive to say about it. They're quite similar and they sort of cancel each other out a bit. Either of them up against Wigan is going to be utterly fascinating, though, because they're so pragmatic and they're so, both clubs are so aware of their failings and the fact that it's long balls, it's guts, it's fitness levels, it's size, it's the antithesis of what Martinez is about. So it will be utterly fascinating, but the replay will not be utterly fascinating.
Millwall v Chelsea at Wembley, time travel back to the 1970s for you, Tony? No?
Oh, please leave, cancelled forever.
Paris Saint-Germain extend their lead in France because Lyon and Marseille are incapable of going beyond a 0-0 draw. Julien, given how awful the top sides in Ligue 1 have been this season, should they maybe just not assign Le Championnat this season?
PSG will win it. They will deserve to win it as well. They've just revitalized the the French football, the French league, the championnat, everything. They're in the quarterfinals of the cup, of the Champions League with your best friend Carlo, and I think they're doing brilliant, and I think they deserve to win that league.
All right, let's put you on the spot, Cap. Right, Milan go to Barcelona this week, Champions League, 2-0 lead in the first leg. Right, one, how did these sides go on the weekend? Two, can Barcelona drag it back?
Well, both sides got on well. Milan defeated Genoa. Pazzini scored a great goal, but then got himself injured. Actually, got himself injured before he scored the goal. It looks like he's going to be out of the return leg. It's a big miss because, of course, Mario Balotelli is cup tied. Barcelona, they only played two regulars. They beat Depor 2-0 at home. Dani Alves showed signs of life, which is good. I think Barcelona can turn this around, but they mustn't concede a goal. It's obvious math is that if Milan score, then Barca have to score four, and that's a huge, huge ask. The really interesting thing is what lineup will Tito Villanova pick, because he can't pick the same people who he picked before, and he's not really there to evaluate them. Of course, he's still in New York getting treatment. So I am just so looking forward to this game. Should be an absolute doozy. That's all we've got time for this week. It's been fun. It's been real. Thanks to my guests, Julian Lawrence, Tony Evans, and because Ollie K is ill, Allison Rudd. Definitely an upgrade. Come find us on Twitter to share your thoughts, or you can email us, as so many of you do each week, gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. Remember, you can go to thetimes.co.uk. You'll find news, views, web chats. I'm doing my web chat tomorrow, Tuesday. There you go. Come and join me if you've got nothing better to do. You'll also find plenty of blogs and analysis. And as I said, all of us are on Twitter, and we love hearing from people we don't know. Till next time, bye-bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.